The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, there's, as usual, a lot of news to talk about, and I'm going to spend most of the time today talking to you about a couple of boring stories. Everyone excited? I'm mostly kidding. These are important stories that affect your lives in very direct ways, but they're ones that are overlooked or dismissed as being boring, mostly because people just don't see the importance of them. One of these quote-unquote boring stories has the potential to make you dramatically poorer. It's about a coalition getting together to attack a source of America's wealth. And the other quote-unquote boring story is about the rise and the clash of empires. It's about a place you look on the map to see who's rising, who's being aggressive. Before I get into those, well, I'll say give you greetings from our new studio. This is my first time actually doing a Trumpet Daily Radio show from up here. I think so far my favorite name suggestion has to be the Trumpet Tower. The other times I've been up here is for recording Trumpet Hour. Having said that, it's not really much of a tower, though there's a nice view out of the window. I came up with one myself, the Lofty Studio, because it's in a loft and therefore it is like a loft, lofty. It's a pun. Sam's not even smiling. Oh well, I guess he doesn't like puns. So yes, welcome from our new radio studio. The other story I just wanted to start with briefly before we got into our boring ones is a quick bit of news from a speech from an American four-star general from this weekend. The Air Force General Terence O'Shaughnessy, he was giving a speech. He was making some statements about the state of the world. And here's what he had to say about America's security.
The world's changed, right? Russia and China, peer competitors, security environment has fundamentally changed. And that middle bottom square is the most critical of all these that are on there, is a homeland is no longer a sanctuary. Our adversaries have the ability to reach out and touch us. And we have to think about our defense in different ways than we have in the past. That means we need to fundamentally rethink, when we say homeland defense, of how are we going to do that against a peer competitor.
So the U.S. is no longer a sanctuary. There are other nations, he's saying, that can threaten the U.S. In some ways, that's a fairly remarkable statement, and it was remarked on in the news. In other ways, it's not. Those type of comments are becoming more and more routine. The Military Times wrote on this. They talked to Air Force Chief of Staff General Dave Goldfein, and they paraphrased him saying, "The warnings may sound dire, but they dial into a changing reality as new domains of conflict open up." They quote him saying, "It's probably dangerous to think that we can physically be a sanctuary when we're in competition below a level of armed conflict and we have a couple of new domains that our adversaries are operating in, cyber and space." There have been a few articles this week about this world becoming more dangerous, about anti-democratic forces rising. But I thought that was one of the clearest in terms of people recognizing there's a growing danger to the West and to the United States. But I'll move into the first of my quote-unquote boring stories. This is an update of what we've been talking about a lot this week, a lot we've been talking about last week, Germany's continual breakaway from the United States. This has been a big and important story over the last week or so. Mr. Stephen Flurry talked about this a couple of days ago, but the news just keeps coming. So we've talked already on this program about this Handelsblatt article at the beginning of last week, this really quite dramatic article penned by Germany's foreign minister, where he talked about how Germany must be a counterweight to the United States, where they must act against the United States when America crosses certain red lines. And they said that in order to do that, the main goal of our foreign policy is to build a sovereign, strong Europe. And Handelsblatt called that a break with 70 years of German foreign policy. So this very public announcement of breaking with America. And then, again, like we've talked about already, there's these concrete actions that Germany is taking, demonstrating that they have the will to follow this statement up. This is not just talking. They are already acting and are willing to act against the United States. And Mr. Flory talked about the way Germany is drawing close to Turkey. You had that article in Spiegel that said part of the reason Germany is drawing close to Turkey is to kind of spite the United States, because America is drawing away from Turkey and they want to oppose America. We also talked about this $20 million aid package they've approved for Iran. So America's piling on sanctions, Europe sending them aid. Well, on Monday, the French President Emmanuel Macron, he very publicly got on the same bandwagon. It's an interesting contraction of bandwagon. Anyway, he said that the EU needs strategic autonomy on defense in a time when the US has turned its back on its old ally. So he also said that this came at the same day that Heiko Maas, the German defense minister, talked about Europe needing financial autonomy. And that's the main thing I want to focus on in just a minute. But Macron, he told French diplomats, we need strategic autonomy and defense to respond to new threats. Europe can no longer place its security in the United States' hands alone. He said the partner with whom Europe has built the post-war multilateral order seems to be turning its back on this shared history. So very much following in Germany's footsteps, and people have been saying, making these kind of comments for the last year or so. And like I've said before, what I think makes this most significant is that there are concrete actions coming from over the last month that back up what these men are saying. So it's not just talk at this point anymore. They're demonstrating that they are willing and able to take action. And Macron pointed to this in his speech as well. He says that Europe has, quote, never advanced so fast on defense integration as it's been doing over the last year. He called for Europe to do more on this as well, to have a greater role in the Middle East, a greater role in North Africa. A greater role, he mentioned Syria, Libya, and the Sahel, this border region just south of Libya. And he talked about rebalancing the world order. So what's that implying? Rebalancing the world order, that America has unbalanced the world order and Europe has to get on the other side of the balance to America, oppose America and rebalance it. Another story, this was just from, I think, yesterday, same subject. Headline, Germany seeking independence from US pushes cybersecurity research. And it was about how Germany wants to end its reliance on America's digital technologies and also on China and other countries. The Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, he talked about this, and he talked about how Germany needs new tools to become a top player in cybersecurity. Ursula von der Leyen, Seehofer said, is our joint goal for Germany to take a leading role in cybersecurity on an international level. Ursula von der Leyen, we have to acknowledge we're lagging behind. When one is lagging behind, one needs completely new approaches. Now, Germany, just last year, they opened up a brand new cyber warfare center. It's a huge center. It dwarfs anything the UK has, and the UK is kind of considered a world leader in this area. And they're authorized to take offensive action in cyber warfare. And they're talking about, well, we need to break more now from America in this. Another headline, German finance ministers urge European defense mergers. Again, this I think was from yesterday. And they want to merge European arms companies, again, so they can compete with the United States. So another practical way that they can break from America. But the main one that I want to talk about doesn't appear necessarily the most significant right now, but could possibly be one of the most significant of all of these different concrete practical breaks from America. And that is America, or Germany, is in Europe, they've announced they want to break away from the SWIFT system. So SWIFT, this is the global interbank payment system. So like I said, it sounds technical, but this has everything to do with your prosperity, with, if especially if you're in the US, your earnings, with having a job, with America being able to pay off its debt and not being in financial ruin. Robert Morley, a trumpet columnist, he wrote on this back in 2015 in an article called Death Blow to the Dollars. And he described the way this system works by writing, whether you're trading in oil, purchasing a boatload of wheat, financing the construction of a mine in Burkina Faso, or buying an Airbus 380, you most likely need dollars, and you need to use the U.S. Interbank Payment System, or SWIFT. Geopolitically, he writes, the dollar's dominance means it can force nations to comply with its will, or, as countries like Iran and North Korea have experienced, revert back to bartering to buy and sell products internationally. So the SWIFT system, that's a bit of a tongue twister, SWIFT system. I'll have to say that 20 times before coming on the show next time. This SWIFT system means that even when European countries are doing business with Iran, it goes through the SWIFT system, and it means they're using dollars. Like he brings out, a European company could be buying something from Burkina Faso, but because of the SWIFT system, America still has something to say about that transaction. And that gives the United States a lot of advantage. Mr. Morley, he had another article around the same time, and he describes what is at stake when we're talking about the SWIFT system. He said the loss of reserve currency status would leave America without the freedom to create money out of thin air to finance government spending. All things being equal, interest rates would be higher, borrowing rates would fall, banking profitability would shrink, consumer spending would contract or constrict, corporations would become less profitable, jobs would be cut, and stock prices would fall. Additionally, America's large debt and retirement obligations would become even less likely to be paid. In short, America's standard of living would trend towards the typical Chinese person's, while China's would trend towards America's. And he writes that he concluded that particular article by writing, the dollar's road to oblivion could be short and swift. So the fact that the world uses this system, it means America has not gone bankrupt. It means that if the US keeps printing dollars, people still want dollars because they need dollars to buy anything internationally. People know that, and so they're more willing to lend America money because they're more likely to think, well, if America runs into trouble, they can print money and pay us back. You start to lose that, America can't print money, and people are less willing to loan America money. America's got a massive debt right now. It just needs the interest rates to go up a few percent, and it becomes unaffordable. And look how divided America is today. What happens if you start to get the government can't pay its bills, it has to cut back on social programs? How would the left respond to that? How would Donald Trump's critics respond to that if he starts being forced to slash welfare because the state just doesn't have any money anymore? You can easily see how that can lead to riots on the streets and complete breakdown. So that's what's at stake when we're talking about this SWIFT system. And Europe is working on now their own system. They want to replace the SWIFT system. And they want to move away from the dollars. This is from Deutsche Welle. Working on creating a European payment system independent of the dominant existing system, international system SWIFT, has already begun. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said at the opening of an ambassador's conference at the foreign ministry in Berlin on Monday. And Heiko Maas, he said, is therefore essential that we strengthen European autonomy by establishing payment channels independent of the US, a European Monetary Fund, and an independent SWIFT system. Now, SWIFT is based in Belgium, but because of that dollar-denominated, the way it works, America has a lot of power over it. The French finance minister, he made similar comments. He said, with Germany, we are determined to work on an independent European or Franco-German financing tool which would allow us to avoid being the collateral victims of US extraterritorial sanctions. That was the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire. Deutsche Welle talked to a lot of experts, and they said, I mean, it sounds like a big deal to kind of create an international a rival to SWIFT. But they said, you know, this is doable. They spoke to Christopher Bovis, a professor of international business law at the University of Hull. And he talked about how this was already happening. He said the European Commission has been developing a system, a parallel system to SWIFT, which will allow Iran to interface with European financial systems, European clearing systems, using the nomination supported and created by the European Investment Bank based on the euro. And a lot of this does have to do with the sanctions against Iran. Mr. Morley, again, he talked about this going back into 2005, because America uses the control and the dominance that it has in the SWIFT system to really attack some of these nations that it wants to go after. And it is in a lot of ways a fantastic tool for American power. Mr. Morley wrote about this. He said, in June 2014, the U.S. Justice Department fined the French bank BNP Paribas $8.9 billion for using dollars to facilitate trade with Cuba and Iran, even though the bank was not breaking any French law. America didn't like that it was helping these nations, so the bank was forced to pay up or be locked out of the U.S. monetary system, a financial death sentence. The bank paid, as did Britain's Standard Chartered Bank, Germany's Commerzbank, and Switzerland's UBS, among others. The French said that they regarded this as economic warfare. And Mr. Morley writes, you might agree that it was appropriate for America to target foreign banks doing business in countries America was sanctioning. It is ironic that America is now eliminating sanctions on Iran and Cuba just months after collecting record fines and punishing foreign banks and pushing foreign banks to leave Cuba. But the undeniable result of this and similar actions is a world looking for a new system that avoids the dollar and U.S. control. And that's exactly what we're seeing now with Iran, because now the sanctions are coming back on Iran. America is using the system in the same way. They're telling European companies and banks, you trade with Iran and we will cut you out of the dollar-denominated system. You won't be able to trade with us. And the banks don't like being told that. And like Mr. Morley said, I think there's a lot to be sympathetic about and even to support about America taking that hardline stand and clamping down on Iran and stopping Iran from gaining access to this foreign currency. But the reaction it's having is it's making all of these companies look at moving away from America and away from that SWIFT system. Especially now after the Iran deal ended, European companies were able to make a lot of money from trading with Iran, and they'd like to keep making that money if they can. Now, I think it's very likely that Europe won't get an alternative set up in time to keep allowing these businesses to keep doing business with Iran, but it has pushed Europe to look in that direction. Mr. Morley, he quotes the Sovereign Man economic blog, writing, after years of endless wars, spying, debt, money printing, bailouts, and insane regulations, the rest of the world has had enough, and they're looking for an alternative. And that's just really heating up now even more with America pushing with what's happening with the Iran deal and European companies being pushed away from doing business with Iran. Going back to some of these, what's going on within the SWIFT system within Europe right now, the Deutsche Welle, they quoted the same expert, Christopher Bovis, saying, at the moment, we're on a head-on collision course between two continents, between two economic systems. and the utilization of the financial regulatory environment, including SWIFT, including payment and clearing systems, is used to promote the economic and diplomatic goals of the US, and the EU is responding quite successfully. So he's saying we're heading for an economic clash, a clash of economic systems. They quote from another expert, Thorsten Benner. He's a director of the Berlin-based think tank Global Public Policy. He told Deutsche Welle that America would for sure seek to divide and pressure the EU. He said the EU is developing an independent system, making it immune from US sanctions. He said that this very much threatens key US interests in the perception of the Trump administration. And he also points out, I think this is interesting, and we'll talk about why in a minute, China has the necessary independent system for this if it chose to use it. And he said that this is the direct effect of the US weaponization of the interdependence and choke points such as SWIFT. The EU played along as long as it was in its interest, and now it is biting back as the secondary sanctions target EU and its key foreign policy interests. There's another. This was from Zero Hedge, but I forgot to write down which other website they pulled it from. But one of these economics blogs, they wrote, "Once again, we see the world moving closer together in centralization while the US is being systematically cut out." That's what we're seeing with what's going on in Europe. The world moving closer together while America is being cut out. And this is something hugely prophetic. This is something we've been talking about at the trumpet for years. The rest of the world coming together financially and cutting out the United States. That's what we see them working on in Europe. All around the world over the last few years, countries have been working on their own versions of SWIFT. China, like we've read, they've got theirs together. Russia began testing their independent version of SWIFT at the beginning of the year. Europe is now putting together its independent version of SWIFT. And all of these different powers, they're all coming together financially and they're all opposing the United States. And we've been forecasting this because the Bible has a lot to say about a power rising in Europe. We've been talking about that all week with this rise of Germany. But it says a lot about this power being an economic power, a financial power. You know, Revelation 17 was one of the key scriptures that talks about the rise of this power. You can go to that passage and learn so much about it. It tells us that it's led by a woman. And a woman in the Bible is the type of the church. So it's led by a church. It tells us that in scriptures like Revelation 17:10, that it is led by seven different leaders and they come, or seven different regimes, and they come one after the other. So there's a sequence. There you have one outbreak of this empire, it dies away, another one replaces it. It tells us that the last of these seven periods that this empire goes through will be made up of 10 kings that unite their power and that, you know, combine their forces, submit to one overall king, one overall strongman. It even tells you that God would reveal this scripture to a man during the time of the sixth resurrection of this power, and gets really detailed about even when God would teach us about this power. But then Revelation 18 also has a lot to say about the character of this power. It tells us it will be an economic power. It says that when it finally falls, the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her because they were made rich by her. It talks about all of the trade that she does. It talks about merchants of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls. And it's a long list of all of the things which were bought and sold. So this power that's coming in Europe will have a strong financial component. But then more than that, you've got scriptures talking about this getting together financially with other nations. Isaiah 23 describes, well, the Old Testament, that when they're talking about this same power. It often refers to it as Tyre in type, because back when the Old Testament was written, the Phoenicians of Tyre were the big merchant trading power of the time. These were the ones that were traveling all around the Mediterranean and much further, establishing colonies, running trade, and were very famous as merchants. Isaiah 23 talks about this Tyre joining a mart of nations with the powers in the east. It refers to China and Japan using their biblical names of Kittim and Tarshish. And so it talks about these powers forming a mart of nations, a trading bloc, a financial system where they all trade together. Ezekiel 27 refers to this same power, and God calls this Tyre a merchant of the people for many isles. So again, it does business with all of these nations all around the world. You look at other scriptures like Revelation 13, and another scripture about this European power, and it says that people won't be able to buy or sell without the approval of this power. So it's a great trading empire, but the government has huge control over the economy as well. It really controls the financial system. So you've got these prophecies of a great trading empire. And then there are other prophecies of the United States being cut out of the global trading system. God warns America in Deuteronomy 28 that if they turn away from him, they'll be besieged. They'll be cut off from trade. They won't be able to buy and sell internationally. Ezekiel chapter 4 and 5 talk about a siege as well. So when you look at all this, the stories about SWIFT aren't a boring piece of technical economic news anymore. They are, I mean, just even when we look at those in more detail, they're sobering. They are, they're sobering and they are very important. The breaker's just flipped in our studio, but we've got battery backup. That's the nice thing about not being in the basement is we've still got the window, so we can see some light from there. Interesting. Power's flicking on and off again. We've got to hope the battery lasts. I'll just say in advance, if this cuts out and you start hearing music, then you know that we've just lost power here. Perhaps if we can find a way to turn off the screen in there on the Apple machine, we might be able to eke out the power a little longer. But I don't know how, with the desktop, it's able to turn off that. Anyway, we'll just keep talking about the SWIFT system. I mean, even just looking at the details in that we can see and that we can understand by looking at the economic system, this is something that's not boring. This is something that affects our everyday lives. This is something that is going to impact us and that we should be concerned about. But then we add in these Bible scriptures, and well, that just adds in a whole nother dimension of interest to this story. Because rather than just being bad news, it's also inspiring proof of the Bible. Proof of what God has revealed, what Mr. Flurry, Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, and before him, Herbert W. Armstrong, have been saying based on the Bible. You've got, it becomes not just a sobering or maybe even depressing story, but an inspiring one as well. It's one that proves the Bible has a lot to say about what we're seeing in the news right now. We've got all of these countries coming together, and I mean, I'll read that quote again. Once again, we see the world moving closer together in centralization while the U.S. is being systematically cut out. And you can go back, to 2011. I should have brought the quotes with me and read what Mr. Flurry was writing in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, based on Bible prophecy, based on these scriptures that we've talked about. And that could almost be word for word, a quote from that booklet. The entire world moving together while America is being systematically cut out. That's exactly what the Bible forecasts, and that is exactly what we see happening on the world scene now. Now, if you want to learn more about that, like I said, you can read our free book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. That has a lot of, that book, it talks about this news that we see going on right now. It also has a lot of very inspiring prophecies that same book makes, talking about what happens shortly after this time, where the whole world is moving closer together in centralization and cutting out the United States, targeting the United States, even attacking the United States. The book has a lot to say on what comes after that. And we can prove what the Bible says, what the book of Isaiah says in current news. And then Isaiah makes a whole load of predictions about a wonderful world that's coming just soon after these current events. So you can get that book, and not only can you understand world news better, but it gives you the hope from world news that all of this is leading to a better world. And it helps you prove and rely on that hope of a better world. So you can get that free book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. You can write for that, or you can read it all online. You can request that. We're happy to ship it for free anywhere in the world on our website, thetrumpet.com. So just a really clear and exciting example of the Bible being accurate, being useful, giving us insight into world events. Well, I'll take a quick break, and then we'll talk about my second quote-unquote boring story.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Sorry to disappoint you, this is still Richard Palmer. Not Mr. Flurry, but you may be pleased to know that the power seems to be back on and stable. Not sure exactly what the issue is or was, but some part of the power kept going down, and hopefully we kept on going out. I've not had any emails come through saying what on earth's going on in there, so I'm assuming that we've been broadcasting live and that the battery backups have all worked throughout those outages and the power flickering on and off. Well, we were just talking about trade wars, about America being cut out from the worldwide banking system, about a new SWIFT system. But I promised you a second boring story that I'm sure you were all very excited and looking forward to hear about. And this relates to, again, a subject we've been talking a lot about. German Chancellor Angela Merkel meeting with, dealing with Russia, talking to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Because they've been meeting quite a lot recently. You've had you've had Merkel and Putin meet a couple of times in the last 4 months. And then the chief of the Russian General Staff met Merkel in Berlin in July. It was a meeting that the Free Democratic Party spokesman called odd and regrettable, and he said it was surrounded by a suspicious silence. And these nations, they've said that these talks revolve around Ukraine, Syria, and Russia's new gas pipeline to Germany. And these are big, significant issues. These are issues where Russia and Germany talking have a lot of prophetic importance as well. So I've no doubt these were discussed, and it's important to keep watching and talking about those discussions. But there's one more subject of great importance to both these powers that I suspect they may have been talking about. And if they weren't, they will be talking about it very soon. And that is the Balkans. This is not just some far-off place in Europe. This is a place where empires clash. It's a place of geopolitical confrontation. It's a place that often exposes which powers are rising, which powers are falling. Because of this, it has played a very important role in history. The trigger for World War I came from the Balkans and the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Friedman, George Friedman, has a good description of the Balkans in his book Flashpoints. He writes, "My father used to tell me to stay out of the Balkans. It was, he said, a dark place where you could be killed for the change in your pockets or a careless glance. In France before World War II, the word Balkan was associated with violence and was being uncivilized, as in calling a thug Balkan. I felt that things had improved. During the Cold War, Yugoslavia was considered enlightened compared to other communist countries. Then the 1990s came, and the Balkans, or at least the Yugoslavian region, started living up to their old reputation. The Balkans are a fragmented region, caught between three great powers, Turkey to the southeast, Russia to the east and northeast, and the Germanic countries to the northwest. Great European empires met and dueled here. Historically, none of these great powers stayed in the Balkans. Each was on its way to somewhere else, somewhere more important. The Balkans were a defensive bulwark or a springboard rather than a destination. In the 14th century, the Ottomans transited on their way to great prizes to the north. The Habsburgs came through, pushing the Ottomans back. In the 20th century, the Soviets hoped to get ports on the Adriatic, but were blocked by the Yugoslav communists, who turned on the Soviets. And he says, in passing through, they all left tracks here. Muslims here, Catholics there, Orthodoxes elsewhere, in a religious and ethnic hodgepodge. So an area that, because it lies between all of these powers, really exposes a lot of geopolitical confrontation. And what I think is interesting is at the same time you've got all this focus on Putin and Merkel meeting and some of these talks between Russia and Germany, the Balkans is going through some of its most significant changes in years. Is that coincidence? I certainly think it's something to watch. So just to recap quickly some of the history there, you had Croatia and Slovenia split off from Yugoslavia in the early 90s, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. You had a lot of war there at that time. The Bosnian War ended in 1995. In 1999, NATO forced Serbia to withdraw from Kosovo. Shortly afterwards, Croatia and Slovenia were admitted to the European Union. Then in 2008, Kosovo again formally declared independence, and this declaration of independence from Serbia, it's been recognized by only 111 out of the 193 United Nations member states. So a bit over half of worldwide, but definitely not universal acceptance. And since then, not really much has changed in the region since about 2008. It's kind of full of disagreements and potential disagreements, but it's all remained frozen. But just over the last year or so, that started to change. Europe has started to move much more quickly into the Balkans. In 2017, Montenegro was admitted to NATO, and that was something that came through fairly quickly. Then over the summer, the EU put Albania and Macedonia more firmly on the road to EU membership. Provided they meet certain conditions, they will be able to begin formal membership talks in 2019 with the goal of joining the EU in 2025. Now, the EU has been reluctant to do this for a long time because joining the EU means the EU kind of has a goal of having all the EU nations up to the same living standard. And so if poorer nations join, they get access to a lot of money from the European Union. Where goes power again? So they haven't wanted, after the 2008 financial crisis, they haven't really wanted to take care of some of these poor countries. So you've instead, they've instead kind of, well, we've got, we'll take Croatia in, we'll take Slovenia in. These parts of the Balkans are much, you know, they're the kind of the Catholic parts, the ones that were part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the ones that culturally are much more closely related to the European Union. However, they kind of left the rest of the European Union. They left the rest of the Balkans outside the EU. They had a lot of control there. They didn't bother putting them on the path of EU membership because of this expense, because they'd have to give them a lot of money to catch their living standards up. But then, more recently, you've had Russia and China trying to move into these areas, these kind of spaces that Europe didn't dominate too strongly. China has been pouring a huge amount of money into this. They're talking about building our high-speed rail link from the port of Piraeus in Greece, where they've invested a lot, up through the Balkans, putting a lot of attention in this area. And I think this is what's prompted Europe to get much more involved and to say, well, okay, other powers are moving in there. We need to formalize our control of this area, otherwise we could end up losing out. I remember several years ago, the European Commission President, Romano Prodi, he said, in the long run, the Balkans belong strictly to the EU. They see it as their area. And yep, they've been able to dominate that area without having all of these nations join the EU. That's over. That they're kind of worried that that period might be over, so they're starting to let them come into the EU. So that's some of the greater background. Then just over the last few weeks, there's been a really remarkable development in this area. And again, this is at the same time that all of these powers are talking. This started to come out in July, where, well, Geopolitical Futures called it a bombshell report. We had a bombshell report in the Kosovo-based Gazeta Express. And it claimed that Russia and the United States had agreed to a possible partition of Kosovo at the Helsinki summit. So under this proposal, Kosovo would give up some regions where ethnic Serbs are in the majority. Those Serbs would get to go and belong to Serbia. And in exchange, Serbia would recognize Kosovo's independence. And the details of this haven't been published, and maybe that would also include Serbia giving up some areas that are mostly Albanian, and that could go and be part of Kosovo. And this kind of proposal then came out into the open over the weekend. The Kosovar president and the Serbian president, they spoke at the European Forum Alpbach in Austria, and both said they were keen to reach a deal, and both talked about this. Because for these two powers, both of them are locked out of the European Union until this dispute is settled. You've got in the EU, you've got nations like Germany that are saying, well, that want Serbia to be independent, and they're saying, we're not going to admit Serbia to the EU until they recognize Kosovo. Meanwhile, you've got nations like Spain that have their own independence movements that they're worried about. And they don't want to encourage nations unilaterally declaring independence. So they're saying, well, we won't let Kosovo in until Serbia has recognized them as independent. So both Serbia and Kosovo are locked out of the EU, and they're cut off with all of that money that comes with EU membership until they get this sorted. And at this meeting, they sounded very keen to get it sorted. And they both made it clear that they would consider these kind of border changes, this kind of partition of Kosovo. The Kosovar president, he said, countries of our region, EU member states, or other countries in the world should not be opposed or be afraid of a potential peaceful agreement between Kosovo and Serbia, even if such a deal might include border corrections. And that's the first time that these two leaders have endorsed this kind of proposal. Then on the same day, the EU announced that it would mediate. They announced they would mediate some talks between Kosovo and Serbia on September 7th. So you've got these talks now pushing forward. America, until now, has always been opposed. Well, everyone's been opposed to border changes in the Balkans. America has as well, but they dropped that. They dropped that opposition. Here's what U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton said on August 24th.
So there are other conflicts, but probably the remaining dispute between Serbia and Kosovo is one of the most significant outstanding. A lot of people have tried to mediate it. Those efforts have failed, but I think there are new signs that both governments very quietly may be willing to negotiate on this. Our policy, the U.S. policy, is that if the two parties can work it out between themselves and reach agreement, we don't exclude territorial adjustments. It's really not for us to say. It's obviously a difficult issue. If it weren't, it would have been resolved a long time ago. But we would not stand in the way. And I don't think anybody in Europe would stand in the way if the two parties to the dispute reached a mutually satisfactory settlement.
So they're open to the idea of revising borders. Now, German Chancellor Angela Merkel explicitly rejected this idea last month. But Johannes Hahn, the Austria's EU commissioner, or member of the European Commission, he said, we should leave it to them. Finding a solution will be supported by us if the overall setting is okay. And it remains to be seen how strong Germany's opposition to that is, whether it's just Merkel's opinion, whether other people share it. But this could be a ground-changing development in the Balkans. And like I said, I think it's really interesting that this has come up at the same time as you have all of these discussions between Russia and Germany. And this is a bigger change than might appear at first. It kind of seems like no big deal. Okay, yeah, well, why don't we just change the borders so people can be in the country they want to be in? However, well, Geopolitical Futures explained it well. They wrote that changing these borders would open a Pandora's box. They wrote that if Kosovo and Serbia start redrawing borders, there's nothing to stop Albania from wanting to redraw its borders with Macedonia, which has a large ethnic Albanian minority, or Croatia from wanting to redraw its borders with Bosnia, which is a substantial ethnic Croat population. For this reason, partition has been a non-starter until now, not just with the Balkan countries, but also for the United Nations, the European Union, and the United States, which together have overseen the development of the region into what it is today. Changing borders in this part of the world, they write, is playing with fire. But putting out one of the biggest border disputes on the European continent might be worth the risk. If it goes wrong, though, everyone involved might wish they'd left the fire alone. So it is playing with fire. You know, there are a lot of Serbs, for example, in Bosnia who would much rather be part of Serbia. And if you start having border changes, well, people are worried, are they going to start agitating to be part of Serbia? Would they even start fighting to be part of Serbia? And you've got this problem even beyond just the Balkans. There's a lot of Hungarians and a lot of Hungarian regions where most Hungarian and they would rather be in Hungary, but they're in part of Romania. You've got parts of Italy that were historically and would much rather be parts of Austria. So they're worried that if you start adjusting borders, that this would spread, that this would catch fire, that this could destabilize the Balkans again. So any changes in this potentially explosive part of Europe, that's got to be concerning to Germany. The Balkans, like we said, this is where the major powers in the region, Germany, Russia, and Turkey, collide. And if they don't want a dramatic collision, well, then collusion is the best option. And we've written extensively about how Germany caused the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. At the UN, some referred to the breakup of Yugoslavia as Genscher's War because of the role that the German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, played in starting it. And the Croats have even built statues to Genscher. You know, they see him as the one that started the war that got their independence. There's a popular song within Croatia, Danke Deutschland, thank you Germany. Because they see that it was Germany that broke them away from Yugoslavia. They went about against the world in recognizing Croatia and Slovenia as independent in 1991. The New York Times, they wrote at the time that in its unusual assertiveness in moving ahead with a plan to extend diplomatic recognition to the breakaway Yugoslav republics of Croatia and Slovenia, Germany has stirred troubling historical associations. Then U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said that Germany had a certain responsibility for that war. And then once that war was underway, Germany violated both their own law and international law to funnel arms to anti-Serbian forces. The Telegraph, they wrote that Germany appears to be Croatia's largest arms supplier during the war, although this is in violation of German law prohibiting the shipment of arms to active war zones and a violation of the UN arms embargo on Yugoslavia as well. You saw them working with Iran to get weapons to some of the Bosnian Muslims. Basically, anyone who wasn't Serbian, they'd funnel arms to. There were instances where the German Secret Service were caught disguising arms as European aid to smuggle it into the country. But at the, so this is something that you know Germany has got to be concerned about what's happening now. But Russia is as well. You've got to know they're watching too. The breakup of Yugoslavia was a key moment in Russian history. It was in the early 1990s. The Soviet Union had just collapsed, and then Yugoslavia, which Russia didn't want broken up, it was broken up, and it just completely demonstrated that Russia was imposed the Kosovo War. And nope, it was completely ignored. Didn't happen. And, well, in a 2014 speech, Putin said, "We remember 1999 very well. It was hard to believe, even seeing it with my own eyes, that at the end of the 20th century, one of Europe's capitals, Belgrade, was under missile attack for several weeks. And then came the real intervention. Was there a UN Security Council resolution on this matter allowing for these actions? Nothing of the sort," he said. Nothing of the sort. And here's, well, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he talked about these comments on the Key of David and how important Kosovo is to Russia. And we'll play a quick clip from that now.
He said, "This happened in Yugoslavia. We remember 1999 very well," he says. "We remember that. It was hard to believe, even seeing it with my own eyes, that at the end of the 20th century, one of Europe's capitals, Belgrade, that's the capital of Yugoslavia, was under missile attack for several weeks, and then came the real intervention. Was there a UN Security Council resolution on this matter allowing for these actions? Nothing of the sort. Russia didn't even have an opportunity to give their input. And now we want input on Russia's interfering and taking over the Crimea, which is, again, mostly inhabited by Russians. But Russia has veto power in that Security Council, and of course they were left out. But the thing about it is this. When Vladimir Putin says, "Look, we remember 1999. We remember what happened," he's saying that they not only remember it, but they have deep emotional feelings about it. And he still rages about that today.
So this is something they have deep emotional feelings about. They're very concerned about what was happening in Yugoslavia. It's a rage, as he said, that still burns. And so you've got to know that Russia will be paying attention to what's happening in the Balkans right now as well. So, well, what is going on now? What these different powers think, what they're doing, what they might be talking about behind closed doors? Well, that's not entirely clear. But we can be certain that they're both interested. I mean, could this be Putin believing that he could destabilize the region by making borders a subject of debate again and maybe get people fighting over those borders, which would be a huge threat to Europe? You'd have the refugee crisis multiple times worse if there was another Balkan war on the border. Does Putin believe he can create a Russian-backed rival in the region by strengthening Serbia? Or is he trying to gain leverage in some kind of negotiation with Germany? Okay, well, you know, don't play too hard here, because if you do, we can mess things up in the Balkans. Or is it something different? Is it that Germany and Russia are kind of trying to come to a final settlement over the Balkans, where they can put this difference to bed and get on with working together in other ways? We don't know, but you know it's going to be important for what they're, and something that's on both of those powers' radar, and something that they're talking about, if they're not talking about it already. This area, like I said, it demonstrated Germany's rising ambition as they just seized that opportunity to break Yugoslavia up and extend their influence and go against the rest of the world with, as the New York Times said, unusual assertiveness in backing their World War II allies. You can read more about this crucial time in our free booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry. I mean, we talk a lot about what the Bible says, and the Bible gives powerful warnings about the role modern Germany will play. But just this recent history, not even that long ago, the 1990s, gives us a powerful warning about the role that Russia will play. I mean, the role that Germany will play in the world. You can see their ambition. You can see what they're willing to do, their assertiveness, just by looking at that history. And if you keep watching that region in the Balkans, undoubtedly you'll see more of that. Mr. Flurry, he talked about this German ambition rising in his article, his recent article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. He quoted Jeremiah 1 and verse 13, saying that this records God showing the prophet a vision of a seething pot and the face there is towards the north. Mr. Flurry wrote, beneath the surface, that nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. And we saw that with the Balkans in the past. If you keep watching the Balkans, you may well see it again. All of those trends that Mr. Flurry talked about in that article, Germany and Russia's secret war against America, the rise of Germany, Germany's ambition, Germany allying with Russia, Germany turning against the US, well, you could still soon get a great look at all of those by what's going on in the Balkans. It's really interesting to see this happening, like I said, at the same time as you've got this focus from Mr. Flurry and just even in world events of Russia and Germany talking together. So keep watching that, and to really understand what is going on in the Balkans and that history that really exposes Germany's role in the world, write for our free book, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. Again, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and we'd be more than happy to send that to you for free. Well, thanks for listening. That's about it from me, and hopefully you can tune in for some more reliable power supply tomorrow here on KPCG.